Welcome to Korean Context, a behind-the-scenes conversation with the scholars, artists and opinion makers that bridge our two worlds. My name's Chad O'Carroll and I'll be your host today. With worldwide familiarity of Korean pop culture increasing from the viral exposure of Korean musician Psy's hit record Gangnam Style, this episode we speak to Mark James Russell, author of Pop Goes to Korea. Having lived in South Korea for over 13 years, Russell's is a regular writer on Korean culture and entertainment for the New York Times, Newsweek, and Hollywood Reporter, amongst others. Having also spent several years developing and producing documentaries about Korean pop culture and history, Korean Context thought he would make an ideal candidate for trying to understand South Korea's increasing prominence in the world of music, film, and the arts. What does the rise of Psy tell us about the popularity of Korean music in the United States? How is the internet helping Korean content creators reach new audiences worldwide? And what role can government play in catalyzing the cultural output of a people? Mark answers all these questions and more in a podcast that is essential listening for anyone interested in Korea's growing cultural output. But while many say the Hallyu or Korean wave has swept most of the world, I started the interview by asking Mark which territories it had been most successful in and to describe those markets that it was still having difficulty in penetrating.
You know, the world pop market is very big, and obviously K-pop is not dominating all the charts all the time. It's done very, very well in Japan, and it's done well in East and Southeast Asia in general. But it is still new, or relatively new, and growing in most other parts of the world. It's surprising how many parts of the world that it's in, but it's still more of a niche than a dominant genre.
And in terms of the influence and impact of the Korean wave, are there any patterns that we're seeing in what type of output is become the most popular? Is it Korean dramas, the K-pop, Korean movies, comics?
One problem I have with the word Korean wave is it appeals, the different aspects of Korean culture appeal to such different demographics. I don't think it's one thing. So when you talk about Korean movies doing well abroad, you're usually talking about film festivals, older, often men, more extreme, more adult content. Whereas with pop music and TV shows, it's often more female. It's often not extreme. It's often much more, if not wholesome, at least broad and mainstream content. There, comics would be different again. So do you think
the term Hallyu then is a bit misleading?
I've never been happy with it. One of the big points of my book Pop Goes Korea was that I think the term is such a black box, it confuses more than it explains. And what we're looking at when we look at the spread of Korean culture abroad is, to my mind, much more about modernization and where the world is going in the future. And because of the internet and because of all these technological changes, you're seeing a lot of the old walls and a lot of the old bottlenecks being broken down and removed. And people are just watching what they want to watch, and they're listening to what they want to listen to. And that, in general, is a lot more diverse than what the old executives, the old people in charge used to think.
But, of course, the internet can't be all of it, because, we've seen a spread of these Korean dramas, for example, in countries where internet isn't as widely used. And that's mainly been through, I guess, broadcaster to broadcaster deals that are being put in place. So is that still a significant part of it, or do you think...
Cable TV was a huge part of the Korean wave because, in the old days, for many years in most countries, you'd have 2, 3, 4 television stations. But then increasingly, people are bringing in cable, and suddenly you have 20 or 30 or 40 or 400 now. So you had to fill up your TV. These new stations needed content. They needed programs. But Americans tended to sell their programs for a lot of money. So you can't have nothing but Friends all the time. Although Korea did try for a couple of years, it felt like. And you know, you just don't have the money, and you can't go to the same well that many times. Japan traditionally sold its content for a lot of money too, nearly as much as the American programs. So that's what happened in the late 90s. You suddenly had places like Taiwan that had more channels and needed more content, and they just couldn't afford and couldn't get enough of the usual stuff. So that's when they started trying out Korean stuff. And Korean stuff at the time was super cheap. And, you know, the guys, it was funny because there was a time when the guys at the Korean TV stations who were in charge of selling the stuff abroad, that was like the worst job you could have. They were just, if you got assigned with that, you had to go to the, you know, was it MIPCOM, the big television market in Cannes in April? And if that was your job, you were just sad. You had this tiny booth at the sub back basement, you know, near where all the pornographic content guys are selling their stuff, and you're just kind of sitting there by yourself and being ignored. But then it began to change. So all of a sudden, you know, Taiwan needs programming, and Thailand, Hong Kong, all these places around Asia need stuff. And the Korean stuff did fairly well. It was similar enough, you know, that it wasn't alienating, but it also looked good. It tended to have better production values than the stuff that was being made at home by these countries. So, and you know, there's a certain physical similarity, there's a certain cultural similarity, you know, with the family units and all this stuff. So Korean TV content really caught on quickly. And I think TV is important because it's the not the softest, but it's the easiest and most wide stream form of content for most people. Like if you want to go to the movies, you have to decide that movie is worth spending my $10 or $5 or whatever on. You've already made the decision it's something you want, where or CDs would be the same. But with TV, you know, you're on the sofa, you're cooking dinner, you're wasting time, and you flick, 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 flick. Oh, what's this? And if you like it, you watch. And so it's a very, you know, for most people, it's a free way of just discovering new things. And from there, it built up this audience. And so people are like, oh, well, I know this person, and this, oh, this person's in another drama. Or sometimes like, oh, that guy's a singer. You know, I saw him on this show, and now he's singing on the radio, or you know, wherever he's singing. So TV was a huge, huge part of popularizing Korean content, and it still is. I mean, that's why when the Korean wave started spreading to the Middle East, in Eastern Europe and South America, TV was a huge part of why it first came to people's attentions.
So you said that you don't really like to characterize this popularity of Korean cultural output as Hallyu. Do you therefore think that this is just going to be a flash in the pan anomaly, or it can be something that's sustainable through, you know, individual enterprise among the artists and content creators?
I really don't think it's a flash in the pan at all. I think that what's happening with the Korean wave, like I said, is the sign of where society is moving in general with technology and other innovations. Just that Korean companies and Korean artists were kind of at the forefront of that change. So just as we've seen, have you become more widespread around the world? You know, Korean pop become more widespread, and you know, you've seen African rock, and you've seen telenovelas and other subgenres. I think that's going to be more common in the future in general. You know, something rises up in one place, and if it's good and it's interesting, it has a very good shot of spreading and catching on like never before. But it's already Korean, you know, what we call the Korean wave has been around a surprisingly long time already. The movies began really attracting some big attention in the mid-90s, around the time the Busan Film Festival got started. The TV shows first started making waves in the late 90s as well, although they, you know, got a lot bigger in 2002 and 2004 with shows like Winter Sonata and Jewel in the Palace. But so there's been like these moments that made it bigger, but it's been around quite a while to be more than just a flash in the pan. You know, Gangnam Style, that could be the next La Macarena, but even La Macarena was followed by a wave of Latino artists that, you know, they weren't as huge as that, but they were very big in their own way, and they developed in different ways, and they formed audiences, and so you have Shakiras and Ricky Martins and all these people that do very well around the region, around the West and the East and everywhere else.
But if what you're saying is true, then we could see, isn't there the risk that Korean output is just going to become part of a wider noise, if you will, of great content coming from cultures all around the world. So in that sense, it will just stand by itself.
At a certain point, the farther off you try to predict the future, the more of a fool's game it is. You never know. And it's a capitalist world. It's competitive. People aren't just sitting around going, wow, look what the Koreans have done. They're looking at what the Koreans have done and going, oh, we want to do that too. So one of the big fun surprises to me was when I started going to film markets and seeing the Vietnam Media Corporation there. And they were very, very consciously making movies and TV shows modeled on Korean movies and TV shows. And one of their first big shows they had, I think it was called 98 Degrees or something like that. It was, a show about, modern young people, in the big city trying to make their way in life. But one of the characters in the show was supposed to be a Korean kid who had come to Vietnam to study the language. And that was like that was a sign of like what would be hip there. So, and Vietnam's continued to grow. I mean, there's no Vietnam wave, but it's an example of a country who's, when they think, how do we get better? They're not just looking at Hollywood. They're looking at Korea. So, it's competitive, but that's always the name of the game. I mean, it's the same thing with cars or any other product or electronics. Yeah, you always have the risk of someone else making a better cell phone or, a better sedan. But once you're good at it, it's much easier to stay good at it.
Now let's talk about the US for a moment. Is there anything about Korean content which doesn't really translate as well into the US market as we've seen in other areas like the Middle East and Latin America?
Yeah, I think so. In general, the US and much of Western Europe is more, I'd say, more cynical, at least in how its content is portrayed, and it's often more violent, more sexual. And so that you don't get as often in Korean popular culture, in the movies perhaps, but TV shows, music, they tend not to go that extreme. So I think when you're from a culture that accepts a certain level of violence or whatever, to then look at stuff that's not as extreme, it often comes across as being softer. And some people like that. I mean, that's a big part of the appeal of Korean dramas. A lot of people prefer not to, not to have the CSI level of gore or the Sex in the City level of sex being confronted by that all the time. But there are other people that will look at something, a TV drama and see these issues and go, that's cheesy or that's, silly or something.
And now, do you think on that very point, do you think that's one of the reasons why Korean popular music has had such a hard time being picked up in the US market? Because, of course, a lot of it is boy or girl bands with quite a synthetic look to them. Do you think that's why Psy, in contrast, was so popular, because it really was something a bit different?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. The issue of gatekeepers, what I brought up before, is a big part of that. Whenever I used to talk to a Western music label A&R guy, and I would always pose the question that Korean music companies pose to me, and that would be, well, when will we have the Korean Justin Timberlake or the Korean Beyonce? And the Western A&R guys would be like, well, we don't want the Korean Justin Timberlake or the Korean Beyonce, because we already have Justin Timberlake and Beyonce. We want something different and weird and exotic and all these kind of Orientalist ideas. But it turns out that a lot of these Western A&R guys don't know their own audiences very well. And so that's kind of the fun of what's happened is you have, these gatekeepers, these executives who are like, oh, audiences want this, they want, shocking, they want exotic, they have all these ideas. And yet when this music kind of goes out there and is allowed to circulate freely, a lot of people like the I guess what some people would call cheesy synthetic boy bands and girl bands. My little sister works at a big insurance company, and she was once reading an article of mine or something, and just random people were walking by going, "Oh, I love those bands," or "I love K-pop." And it's funny how often the decision makers are just so terribly wrong about what it is that their audiences want. I mean, the each fall's TV season, I guess, is the wonderful shiny example of that. The American TV channels put out dozens of shows and maybe one or two catch on.
And what do you think of the Korean government, getting involved in the promotion of K-pop? Is this something that should be welcomed, or are there risks associated with it?
I am in general, at best ambivalent about government getting involved in the arts, especially popular culture like this. I'd say 90, 95% of the time, it's mostly them trying to take credit for things that private artists have done on their own. They're always after the fact. They're always, looking to promote things that already have gotten acceptance, as opposed to recognizing that what the most useful thing that anyone can do, be it a government or philanthropist, is you're providing help for the new and the curious and the unconventional artist who's trying to get started. The guy who's already gotten the big award and has already had the breakthrough thing doesn't really need that much help. But governments in general, and I would say the Korean government is probably worse than most. They tend to want the safe, self-affirming pick. And so yeah, I'm not a big fan of much of the Korean government's support in most of the arts. I guess in film, it's probably been more helpful just because film is more capital intensive. And until recently, the Korean film industry didn't have that much capital. So having someone who could provide editing facilities and studio space was very helpful. But in music and the arts, I mean, K-pop's really, really interesting. But to me, pop does not exist by itself. Pop is part of a continuum, and you have, the avant-garde and the weird and the independent, and you have jazz and classic. I mean, there's all these different kinds of music that are kind of swirling together, and pop is just one aspect of it. But in Korea, pop really, really dominates. But I don't think pop can really exist by itself that much. Look, when Justin Timberlake was becoming a solo artist, he went out of his way to cultivate ties with bands that were considered more respectable, with the White Stripes and people like that. He was always, concerned with being around innovators, even if his musical form is considered less innovative. And you don't get that as much in Korea. You have this amazing independent music scene there that right now is going through a great renaissance. There's so many of these bands that are just kind of rising up on their own and doing this wonderful stuff. And they get very, very little government support, especially before the band has, once the band has gotten out of Korea and can give them press clippings from America, they might get a bit of money. But it's very tough. And, the government is far more focused on the next big K-pop band or something like that.
And on the topic of government support, are there any models out there in the international community of governments that seem to get it right in terms of supporting those independent labels and artists well before they are the next big thing?
I am not an expert on the subject, but I do believe both Japan and Taiwan are much more aggressive about getting their indie artists out there. They, have money and resources to help get them to the big music festival, the places where bands kind of make names, like South by Southwest or the CMJs, things like that. I believe they've helped more in the European festival circuit too, although perhaps not as much because, even Taiwan and Japan, like Korea and so many, non-Western governments and cultures tend to be fixated on the US market. I think that's sometimes a mistake because there is a lot of other money to be made in other places, and sometimes other markets are easy to break into. But like right now, if you went, there's a little college radio station in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. And right now, the number eight album on their chart is Apollo 18, this kind of post-rock, indie Korean band. Really, really good. And yeah, they pretty much have done it on their own. They've organized a couple of tours to Canada and the US, and they just went and, did the press and did the work themselves.
So I guess this begs the question, is it really the role for government to be getting involved in helping promote artists when, obviously they can rise to the top organically, as you say?
They could help, but in general, I think government agendas are different than the artist agendas. It's just the nature of the beast. It's just, governments like to talk about helping the people and being all altruistic, but the fact is, everyone has a boss, and generally, what it takes, what they're looking for to help their resumes and to help their careers is not what the artist necessarily wants or needs. So yeah, if suddenly the Korean government put together a fund and said, we're gonna bring five bands on a tour across Europe to all the big music festivals in June and July, I could only help. It would be could be really, really interesting. Another kind of typical example of what I was just talking about. Coming up later in October and the beginning of November, there are going to be two music kind of conference festival things going on in Korea. Just like Music Matters, which happens in Singapore, I believe, in May each year. It used to happen in Hong Kong. Or like Meet'em happens over in Cannes in France in January. And it's such a typical thing. Korea's never had this, never really had it anyways. Now someone gets the idea they want to do it. And instead of just doing it, you end up with two competing bodies trying to do the same thing 2 weeks apart from each other. Because instead of, figuring out what do we need to do for the artists, you end up having these different factions that are trying to figure out what's best for them.
We've seen more instances of groups who aren't as popular in Korea, such as K-pop, UKIS, LaRaine, finding more popularity abroad. What do you think is affecting those kind of preferences? And is there any correlation between popularity in Korea and popularity abroad?
You often, I think that's a not an uncommon trait to happen anywhere. In Korean movies, one of the biggest Korean directors on the international festival circuit, well, two of them would be Kim Gi-duk and Hong Sang-soo. And no one in Korea watches Kim Gi-duk and Hong Sang-soo films these days. Not, well, I guess the last Kim Gi-duk film actually did okay because it won that big award at Venice. And, it's full of sex and terrible things that people love to watch. But in general, their films get just a tiny few people watching them, whereas a lot of the big Korean blockbusters just don't export as well, and they certainly don't export to the West as well. In part because the movie market's just so tough and so conservative and bloody-minded these days. But you often get that. You have someone who, they're the biggest artist in a country who tries going abroad and, maybe does okay, maybe not. Whereas for some reason, someone who's smaller catches on. You look at Shonen Knife out of Japan. Shonen Knife, I believe, is at best a mid-level indie band in Japan, whereas they're for years were one of the best-known acts in America. And I can't remember how Björk does in Iceland, but Iceland is full of interesting bands that we've never heard of. And Spain, I can think of, these acts, some of the best known Spanish acts, at least among, hipsters and cool stuff or whatever, are very, very minor in Spain, whereas some of the biggest mainstream Spanish stuff just does not travel to America or Canada or UK very well.
Well, Mark, thanks very much for taking part in today's Korean Context. I do hope you enjoyed today's podcast. You can download other episodes at our podcast website, which you can find at keia.podbean.com. That's keia.podbean.com. We'd also really appreciate if you could leave us some feedback using the comment system on either the Podbean website or directly on our iTunes page. If you'd like to suggest a candidate or topic for a future episode, be sure to drop me an email at ocarroll@keia.org. That's ocarroll@keia.org. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you can join us next time.